Hey, it's Vladimira.
And I'm Nectarios.
And this is Naked by the Future Farm.
Join us as we strip entrepreneurship to its vulnerable core. This episode of Naked is as much about our guest's personal experience of mental health as it is about working with founders who have specific needs. But let's start at the beginning. Our guest today is best known in her home country of Estonia as an author of a novel about depression that is part of the school curriculum, based on her personal experience as a teenager. Eija Uus's story sounds incredible, from moving to Thailand all by herself at the age of 14, to be diagnosed with depression at 16, to be misdiagnosed as bipolar, to be misdiagnosed again a few years later, until she finally learns that the reason behind her experience was autism. Did Eija really have to see 10 doctors before she found the right one? We talk about the helplessness of having to rely on a health system that doesn't understand mental health and neurodiversity, the role of medication, and Eija's need to learn about the neurology behind her experience. We discuss how people often associate depression with severe symptoms, but often it's little things, like feeling sluggish or tired, struggling to concentrate, or getting easily irritated. Eija shares with us the cycles of extreme happiness and hitting rock bottom, and how living with a bipolar diagnosis didn't make sense. The therapist who changed her life did it by helping her rewire her brain. It's physiological, in the same way that stress is a chemical process. Understanding the science is key. After a successful career as an author, Eija decides to focus her attention on helping entrepreneurs with their creativity needs, and realizes quickly that the people that come to her workshops are all much more interested in talking about their own mental health experiences. Eija invites us not to give up when looking for help. It may take a while to find the right person to help. Self-reflection is key. Do not be defined by a diagnosis, but figure out what works for you and how does it affect your life. Please meet Eija.
I loved Vladi's mug. It was humongous. It's the biggest mug I've ever seen. It's bigger than your head.
I know, but now I have to show it. You know, it's a tricky one because people always think that I'm like the biggest beer fan. And I'm just a medium. So, but yeah. So, hello, Eija. Hi, Nectarios.
It's a good way to start the episode. Vladi actually has bigger mugs.
I do. You've seen the whole range of them. If you want to, yeah. My core circle knows that if they want to make me happy, they just keep increasing the sizes and we all have a different comfort places. So Max, it is. How are you doing, Eija? It's really lovely to have you on Naked.
Thank you for having me. I'm good. It's we're recording in the summer now. So there's a lot of freedom. There's a lot of heat. There's a lot of, possibility to take time off and just, sit by a sandpit with my kid and now it's good. Ask me again once this airs.
Where in the world are you right now, Eija? Tell us and our listeners.
I'm on Saaremaa Island. So it's this big island of Estonia. And I am in the forest in my country house. Where are you guys?
We love your country house, by the way. For everyone to know, we had this prep call and it was just such a tranquil, very peaceful. Like you feel like, yeah, absolutely want to record. And we were envious in a good way. But it's really nice that you are in a good place in the summer. But before I answer your question, Nectarios, I actually wanted to share something I was reading yesterday on LinkedIn, where one of the investors who we actually know in London, she's quite high profiled and she cares quite actively about founders' health. She made this post about, it's August, founders take a break. And then she literally was like two paragraphs and she said, with the whole macro climate and, situation around funding, and there were a lot of stressors. And she's like, now is the time and it's good. And as an investor, I'm telling you, just go take a break. And it became viral. Like people were just saying, thank you for the permission and for saying it as an investor. So I thought that was really lovely. And you reminded me that spirit now, Eija, because it's August and hopefully we're taking
now or never.
It seems like you are in a good place. Now or never. Yes, indeed. So how is Berlin nectaris? I just spoiled it.
Just spoiled it. I'm in Berlin.
I know.
I'm here for a very personal reason. One of my best friends who lives in Los Angeles is here for a period, and I came here to work from here and get the chance to see him every evening and sometimes during the day. So I'm super happy about that. I'm working on an improvised podcast studio in the hotel room that I didn't book. So I'm a little bit grumpy about that, but this conversation makes me happy and it calms me down. The weather yesterday in Berlin was all seasons in one day. It went from cold to rainy to sunny to hot to cloudy and back. So that was quite exciting. And bizarrely, because you're talking about tranquil environments, I'm as central as it can be near the Gedächtniskirche, which is a memorial church that they didn't rebuild after the war, which is like the main shopping area. And it's surprisingly quiet. It's nothing like London. It's actually, you can go out and the big streets and the tree-lined streets of Berlin in the summer are just glorious. So I'm in a good place and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
I have a feeling that this is going to be a very peaceful conversation, but I think actually we are going to prove this wrong. So out of you two, I think I'm by assumption in the most loudest, craziest place. I'm in London for a change, but actually I'm in within the period, which is quite close to the forest. And we decided not to really go and engage in that craziness this time around. So I think we are getting into this spirit of holidays and just being. So I'm in a good place. I'll share with you guys that we are spending time with our teenager, Nadim's daughter. People know Nadim. So that's new. It opens up a whole array of conversations and questions. And it's interesting. It's interesting. And yeah, also having you as a mother, you know, on the podcast, I think it's quite unique. So let's see, maybe we even touch base on some of those subjects. So, but you know, we do this exercise with our team in Pakistan. Like every Monday we come together as a team and we sort of check in on a scale, like how are we doing from the mental, emotional, physical health. And it's really beautiful that people build that habit. So what we're doing here, I was about to do the same thing. I was about to close my intro by saying on the scale from 0 to 10, I am on probably 8.5. So that's my number right now.
Before we start, I want to point out one thing, because this next new season of Naked is more heavy on the visuals because we're releasing it and promoting it on YouTube. I'm super excited that we have Aya Uz on the call, because Aya and I, we met because we had to. Somebody very smart one day said, you guys, you should know each other because you talk about the same things. And I was a little bit suspicious at the moment. And then we met and I think I fell in love with Aya, and she calls me her big brother. So it's a very interesting relationship here.
Wow. I didn't even know that I'm entering this triangle. This is news for me here. I'm up for the challenge.
In all fairness, when we first met, I was just fascinated by your story, Aya, because it's so multifaceted. And ultimately, we talk to people about the mental health journey, and there's usually one chapter or one thing. And in your case, there's multiple things. So we're really excited that and grateful that you're prepared to share your story with us. So maybe this is a good moment for you just to say a few words about yourself and how we got to talk.
Okay. This is always a hard one. I grew up by the sea in a very tiny village, and had a bit of a difficult childhood in Soviet occupied Estonia. And then when I was 14, I went to study in Thailand for 4 years, all alone. Just lived in a boarding house, and when I was there, I was doing everything I could. All the things that you can't do in a village in Estonia. so we're like student guild and student newspaper and school plays and started writing and like all the sports and just like everything, singing, dancing, mountain climbing, windsurfing, and just a very active life. And then I came down with severe depression, you know, to the point of complete apathy. So, you know, can't get out of bed and, you know, can't move my eyes and so on. And so since I was 16, I started the work getting better, and it has not been like this. So it's been like a very, very, very bumpy ride. And I was firstly diagnosed as bipolar. And recently, I learned that it was a wrong diagnosis that a lot of people get, that actually it's a neurodiversity spectrum. And since I got this diagnosis, you know, it's pretty much like upwards. So yeah, I think these are a couple of important things to me. But so when I was 19, I wrote my first book about depression and mental health, because 20 years ago nobody was speaking about this. And but like, for example, teenager suicides were really, really high rates, and so people at schools read this, and still to this day, 20 years later, I get letters from people saying that this book saved their life. And so like 20 years ago, because of that, I became a mental health advocate, and I've been doing it for 20 years. And then last year I realized I should study more. So I've been reading books and listening to podcasts and everything for 20 years, but now I went to school to actually become a better psychologist and also to protect myself more, like to be able to carry more from people and to be able to help them even more. And I'm a writer, and I'm a creativity coach, and yeah, there's a lot.
Yes. Can we, if I may just continue, you just jumped really quickly from, I went to Thailand at 14 by myself, and then I was doing all the fun stuff, and then I was diagnosed with severe depression. That there's a big jump there, which is first of all, when you told me for the first time that you were living in Thailand by yourself in a crazy city that is really busy and alien and different, and trying to get by, and then you sort of led to this diagnosis of severe depression, this doesn't happen overnight. So how did you realize that you actually, something wasn't right? So were you, did somebody send you to be diagnosed? Did you start experiencing symptoms? Was it a gradual process? Can you go back there a little bit and tell us more about that period of super active life, one moment, and then dealing with your mental health in the other?
Yeah, I remember sitting by the pool alone. Like, we weren't allowed to go swimming alone, but I went to sit by the pool, and I saw my own dead body floating in the pool. And I was just like, what the hell was that? And then just, you know, trying to keep myself together. So in high school, you know, in a way, you don't have that many responsibilities, that like you don't need to earn money to pay for the rent and so on. So you know, I just had to get my school things done. And I guess at one point they became harder and harder to get done. And I stopped sleeping. I started crying a lot. And at one point my parents were visiting me for Christmas holidays. And I spent Christmas and New Year's with them, and they left. And I was alone in a hotel room. And I was just like, I am going to jump out of this ninth floor window. And this was so shocking to me, because I always thought that I'm a happy kid. And And then I called my mom, who thankfully is a psychologist, and she knew a lot of doctors, psychiatrists, and I think I was really, really, really lucky in that way. I think most teenagers, they don't get the support. You know, it's I was extremely lucky. So instantly she found doctors for me to speak to, and then it just started getting worse. So it's not that, you know, immediately I got help, but immediately it was good, but it got worse for like 4 months, and I failed all my exams that year. I was afraid that I'd be kicked out of school, and at the same time I didn't care because I wanted to die anyways. So like something that has been really really interesting to me recently is that because this was my first experience of depression, I have always thought that this is what depression is, and only now I'm realizing that depression is a lot less. Like already when you start having these changes in, you know, your ability to concentrate and your willingness to get out of bed and, you know, you eat differently, you know, it's like these tiny, tiny things that are already considered depression. But for years I thought depression is when you
have like, to.
Yeah, you're rock bottom.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. We got deep and naked very quickly here. Well, but thank you. No, I mean, just a piece of reflection that, you know, there's a lot in there, and thank you actually for being so open and reflective. I'm actually curious if we can look at that period more with all the work that you have done on yourself, and with yourself. How are you looking at that period right now? Like, how are you understanding what was happening? It, to some extent, the word that or the concept that is floating in my mind is that it was some intense traumatic event as well. So I'm curious and take us further. But let's start first by how are we understanding what happened over there today?
So like leading up to it, you know, I must have been in this decline for a very long time, I think I'm a very positive person, and you know, picking myself up every day, and it's like, no, I'm going to do it. And for like 10 years, every time depression hit the same way, that it's like it comes out of the blue, like I'm doing my things, I'm living my life, and then one moment, boom. And so now I'm really working hard at noticing all the symptoms straight away. But still, you know, I want to be positive, and I want to, you know, not the sulk and nothing. Okay, now it's happening, you know, be super, super sad about it. But I think in addition to the fact that that my mom was a psychologist and I could talk to her, and I got medication straight away, It was awful, this medication stuff. You know, a lot of people go to the hospital to try out medication because antidepressants can be really, really like shocking to the system sometimes, you know. All of them say on the information sheet that for the first few weeks, people will probably become more suicidal than before taking these pills. But I have a very, very curious mind. So even though I was 17 at the time, I ordered all the books of Amazon that were on depression and bipolar. And I just like, I needed to understand, because at first, you know, I thought I'm insane. I shouldn't be alive. There's a demon, you know, it's just like, and because nobody was talking about this. And then when I was reading these like neurology books, okay, so it's chemistry. There's this hormone doing this, this doing this. So I think I still see that most people do not approach their depression this way. That it's like, you know, they hear that, you know, you should sleep more and eat better and exercise. And that's like, you know, the level they're like, okay, let's take a pill. So I started off straight away that I want to understand this. Like even at 17, I need to understand this. I need to know like what neurons are doing what. And I think my approach has always been like very scientific. And and also when somebody says that, oh, there's this new therapy that's really good for that. And I'm like, so show me how. I want to know why they think this helps.
I can see how, I guess to some extent, this can really be liberating in a way, I would imagine. And I think it's quite powerful to share this, that maybe the potential sense of like, hey, something is wrong with me, and some sort of a sense of guilt and the exclusion and all of this, right? But it's very, very strong what you are also sharing. I think I'm seeing Natalia's nodding for both of us, sort of just having our own experiences, but just sort of walking this journey with you right now. I'm thinking if we go back into Aya, 17-year-old, and she's doing all this research and getting the books and figuring it out, having the conversation with your mom, what happened afterwards? So you mentioned very gently that you wrote your first book on mental health at 18, which also, to some extent, frankly, does feel like extreme in a beautiful way, but it does feel. Can you tell us a little bit more about this period and what happened there?
Yeah, so on my 17th birthday, I gave myself a promise to stay alive until my 19th birthday. So this was giving them borrowed time. So I'm very thankful every day I get to wake up. But yeah, I thought, you know, I'm just going to turn 18, and then I'm going to go to, you know, try out university and try out sex and try out alcohol. And I was excited, you know, I'm going to be 18. Then for a year, I'm going to do everything that grown-ups do. And then it's like, you know, but things started looking up, and just like this, it really helped me at that time that I made this decision that up until that day, I'll try everything, and it's just sort of like, I'm going to stay alive this second, and this second, and this second. No, inhale, exhale. I'm still alive. Inhale. I'm still alive. Exhale. I'm still alive. So I think like these first months were like learning to walk. It didn't go miraculously well. I think at that time, 20 years ago, doctors also didn't understand a lot about depression, and a lot of the doctors in Estonia at that time were you know, leftovers from like the Russian medical system, or you know, they were like 60 and they didn't understand this condition very well. So I remember I was, you know, 17 and 18, and I went to these doctors, and they were like, oh, but you are a beautiful young woman, you have hands and you have feet and you have a brain, and look at you, you should be happy. Yeah, and yeah. It's like, I know I should be happy, you're right, absolutely, but this is not helping me, this is making me worse. I should be grateful that I have everything. So I got better on medication each time. So it's just rock bottom, then pills, then leave the pills off, then rock bottom, pills, and okay, I don't want to take these anymore. And then it's like, so I just kept doing this for basically 10 years. And then I had like these intense periods of, you know, bad, 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 bad. Then it's like, struggling to live. And then it's just like, woohoo, I'm okay, I'm going to do everything. And then I did everything and I was really happy. And then it's like, rock bottom again.
I mean, the way you describe it, you can see where somebody would go that follows a bipolar type of behavior, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the high highs and the low lows and the sudden changes and all this. We're talking about depression. We're talking about your journey through depression, but we're also kind of, we haven't really spoken about what it feels like to be diagnosed with something like bipolar. So it'd be interesting to hear how that made sense to you, especially with your more scientific approach to things, rather than we're trying to understand what other hormones are playing a role and why is it happening. Did you dig into the bipolar side of things as well whilst you were going through this?
Yes, I did. And there was always things that didn't match. Like there were things that just did not match. I was reading these books and I'm like, okay, I have this. But you know, there, like for example, the cycling, bipolar cycles, that, you know, it has to be like, there's no in between, you're either one or the other and so on. And these like cycle lengths didn't work for me. And when I went to the hospital, there was this young doctor and she thought, you know, it doesn't follow the bipolar, like this doctor also mm-hmm. could see this. And she said, let's try borderline personality disorder. And now when I have my ADHD and autism diagnosis, both of these are often diagnosed as either bipolar or borderline personality disorder. So like, I remember reading about, I was like, oh, okay, so it's something else. And I was reading about this borderline. I was like, what? It's even worse. And so, but I don't know, I guess I also like trusted the doctors and I thought, you know, they're smarter than me. They should know it better. And then, so this trying out all these medications for, you know, 10 years and luckily this doctor said, you know, we're going to get you clean. Like you need to rewire your brain. You need to build yourself a new brain. And I remember, you know, I was 26 at the time and I was like, what is she on about? Mm-hmm. And so she told me about all these, you know, like neurons and synapses, where, you know, your how your brain works, how every single day you build your brain and that you can rebuild your brain.
So basically she told you that you can rewire your brain and you thought that what is she talking about, right? But it sounds powerful also.
So, yeah. So this... I didn't see this again until like recently. I saw it on Instagram on two different accounts, the exact wording that she used on me, and I've been able to help so many people with this, that you know, the pathways in your brain that you use all the time, they become really, really strong and they become like cemented, and out of this little path on a meadow becomes a super highway where, you know, eight lanes, and you know, you can just fly on it. And if you stop using a super highway, after a while it will crumble and the forest will take over. And so I had used, like, for 10 years my go-to thought had been, I don't want to be alive, or like, you know, like with anxious people, these anxious thoughts, like, what if this happens? What if this happens? What if this happens? What if this happens? Mm-hmm. And like, you can actually, you know, change your brain so that it isn't only these thoughts. Like this other thing she said was that your thoughts are like trains, you know. You will always have thoughts. It's not like a radio you can turn off, and you shouldn't listen to anyone who says you can turn off your brain and your thoughts. But so you're at the train station, at the metro station, and this train of thought comes, and you can decide whether you get on this train or you don't. But I had like all these thoughts in my brain, just like driving me crazy. And I thought like, what do you mean I can decide not to go along with a thought? Like if I'm worried about something, you know, I should figure it out. I should really worry about this. And the fact that I worry about it, it means that there is something to worry about. And she said, this thought arrives and you don't get on the train. And yeah, at first, you know, this seemed insane to me, but it actually works. And now I think my go-to thoughts aren't I want to die or you know, this is going to happen. So I was luckily able to rebuild it. And also she said, at the hospital, I saw people who had been depressed for 40 years. And at that point, the brain is, you know, destroyed. If like at that point, there isn't much you can do. You can't, you know, smile at the mirror and you'll be fine. So this doctor was really, really invested. She's like, you're 26. Your brain is still able to evolve. So we are like, up until her, everyone said that I will take medication until I die, you know, like all my life, I will need to take more and more meds. And this woman was like, no, we're just going to rebuild your brain and get you off medication. I was like, what? You're nuts. But I at the point when I went there, I had like nothing to lose. I was just like, I was like near psychosis and overworked and so on. So luckily I had nothing else to lose. So I was like, let's try your way, because the other ways didn't work. And so pretty miraculous.
So Aya, in all this period, you've been writing, right? And we want to link it also a little bit to the specific challenges of somebody who is not a traditional employee, somebody who's building a business, somebody who runs their life as their own brand, right? So you had on the one side your journey with the additional discoveries and the waves of depression come and go and all the other experiences. And then you were continuing to write books. I remember when we spoke the first time, you told me that at some point you realized, and I'm paraphrasing you because those were not your words, but you're writing these books for all the wrong reasons. This is me putting words in your mouth. When did you get to that point where you realize that being the author isn't it? And what happened to get you to change and become this, build this new career around creativity?
I always had other jobs, so writing was never a full-time thing, because I'm a person who needs people. Like I understood this at a very early age that you know, there are these, you know, scholarships and writers retreats where you can just go and write in silence. But I always felt that I need to be in the middle of people to learn about people so I can write about them. And so I always had other jobs, and then like publishing houses and advertising and communications and magazines and all of these different things. And then when I had my baby, I was 3 months pregnant when COVID lockdown hit. So baby, COVID, you know, completely different world. Then I decided that I want to do something that has a future. And what else would one do but go work for fintechs? So
there's so many oxymorons in that statement. Let's go with it.
So yeah, when my baby was a year and a half, I went to work at a fintech, and then from there I went to work for a Web3 climate solutions fintech kind of thing, tokenization and so on, and I just burnt out in like a completely new way. And I realized that like, yes, I can learn it. I have a good brain. I can make sense of this thing. You know, I can teach myself Web3 and fintech and all these mm-hmm. things. But why would I? I had this moment. It's like the fact that I can, should I? And so I thought, okay, but what is it really that I'm good at and what I can give back to society? And then I realized that I should try this. People had been asking me for courses, for like creativity courses. And I thought like, okay, I'll just do one course until I get out of this funk and like figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life. And then suddenly I had 7 courses booked and people came up to me asking for private mentoring. And from like the first day I started doing it, I realized that, okay, so we're talking about creativity, but it brings out like deep psychological, like everything. So like almost every single person who came to my courses or had this individual creative coaching, like every single one of these people, including myself, of course, has these psychological hangups. You know, like somebody has told them when they were 5 years old that you can't draw or you can't sing. So this is like on this like surface level, but also they have said, you know, you're not like, you can't be successful or you'll never amount to much. So it's really, really interesting to me that, you know, I'm talking about how to write better, but then everything comes from underneath. And then because I came from the startup sector, I started working with a lot of founders and realized that, okay, so it's sort of creative coaching, but really, really, it's just the fact that if people are founders, they feel they are not allowed to go see a therapist or a psychiatrist, because what if somebody finds out? They will think my company's in trouble and all my employees will leave me. And so so it was this interesting thing that happened, that sort of, you know, under the hat of like, I want to write a book about startups. I'm like, yeah, come write. And then it turns out that there's a lot more that they need to do instead of writing this book. That this, it's a good excuse, but it's not as important as figuring out some of these things that are holding people back.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense to us, because I feel like ultimately each one of us is also trying to just understand a little better who we are and how we are wired, right? And we use different platforms to do that. I think the creative one, it's a really rich one, because it just shows or allows us to explore parts of ourselves in a very different way. I was very curious about this experience of your life. And maybe the first sort of question is from a place of, with that journey that you have in your own life, and again, all the learnings and the deep self-exploration, approaching this relationship with other people, how did it starting to be useful to you? How are you using those learnings in your work with founders, especially because that's most of our audience. And so the listeners are other entrepreneurs. So I think that's the first question, is maybe coming back from linking your own journey into what you're hearing and the conversations you are having with other entrepreneurs. How is that being useful or not?
I think like also thanks to myself only noticing really clinical depression, you know, like at the lowest low, because I didn't see in myself when depression got really bad or when things started to get worse. I can now notice it in other people, you know, when somebody comes to me and they're like, you know, everything's fine, you know, I'm fine. Everything is great. Mm-hmm. My business is great. My kids are great. My wife is great, or my husband is great, and my friends are great, and everything is great. And I'm just, what the hell is the matter with me? Like, why am I like this? And And like, I recognize this pattern that I also do this, but everything's fine. I mean, everything, like, look around me, everything is great. My work is great. This is great. This is great. But yeah, why are you like this? So this sort of, I think because I have been through these things myself, I will never be like one of the psychologists that I was advised by that. You have hands, you have feet, be happy. So yeah. Hey, like, let's go into this. And I think also most people don't understand stress. Like, most of us think that stress is like stress. And, you know, it's like a fashion word that stress means, you know, being busy, or it's like a state of mind or so on. But stress is actually a chemical reaction. And these chemicals that your brain creates due to the stress, you know, they start doing real harm in your body, to your organs. And this is why it's crazy that it's even taken me years and years to understand. And I'm still, I guess, I'm still actively learning that we, like, the way we talk about stress is really stupid, because it is something that actively harms our body, our blood consistency, our, you know, what our heart does, what our liver does, you know. And then people are really surprised when they're super stressed and, you know, they start get dizzy, or they can't concentrate or so on. It's your body is filled with chemicals that are making it really hard for you to just exist. And do this for long enough, you know, different functions in your brain start switching off. So, you know, the function of memory, suddenly you don't remember things, you keep start losing things, and concentration, and this just goes like, like all these doors start closing. And then at one point, the person is completely like, I don't want to live anymore. And yeah, it's like also, you know, this year with everything, what I'm seeing in founders, it's a really hard place to be at the moment. So
yeah, but we'll get there before. just one thing, Nectarius, because I wanted to react on one thing. We did that first. I wanted to say thank you, Aya, because of saying that it's stupid and whatever, you know, the word. But there was one thing that came out to me, and I was saying to Nectarius when the live kicked in and we had the pause, that it was some of those things, even today, I feel like not enough informed and have enough of knowledge to even start having a conversation about them. So approaching it from a place of curiosity. But I think the amount of misconceptions and the harmful narrative that we feed to ourselves is just humongous. And friend of ours who's been on this podcast, he's a clinical psychologist, Dr. Michael Freeman. He said one thing that stayed with me, and this was, I believe, like a year ago at least. He said that the fact that you go out there and you talk to a psychologist or a therapist doesn't mean that it's someone who is actually informed. So to doing that proper diligence on who is the partner on the other side and what are their sources. And I think it's really important. Like, I feel we need much more of this conversation about like research-based approach and concept, and just be, you know, like, we invest so much time in understanding this, all these other things around the life. And then when it comes to us, we're sort of in this like wishy-washy like concepts and softy touch. Yeah, it's just woof.
And
what were your thoughts? So yes, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So I went to 10 doctors before I found my doctor. And you know, it's like this with everything. Like, you are not going to marry the first person you go on a date with. Like, most of us don't. It's like,
yeah,
you go on a date, you know, the vibe isn't right, or you go on a date, you like different things, and so on. And people just like, most people think that, you know, that going to the therapist is, you know, the last step. You know, you do everything else that you can before you start exercise, change your diet, and so on. And then, you know, if all else fails, I'm going to see this doctor. And people think that they went once, it's done now. It doesn't work like that. And so these people, they can be really educated, they can be really smart, But like, for example, now that I'm becoming a therapist myself, I'm finding out that in our like job description, the first seven times you don't even tag the person. Like the first seven meetings, you're supposed to just like listen and make sense and let this person vent. Like and when people are depressed, you're not even allowed to give them advice what they should do, because these functions in their brain have shut down and they are not able to take this information. Like you mm-hmm. can make it worse for them by saying that, hey, have you thought of doing this? Maybe get a hobby. And it's like, we're not allowed to say that because it would be exhausting and make them feel even worse about themselves. So, like, first of all, you are not going to click with any person you meet, and there are so many different styles of, you know, not only personality, but also like psychology fields, and you know, it also depends what they have seen in their patients. Like if this old fashioned system is that you just give people pills and they get better, and so just give, and like there's this new wave that says, whatever you do, don't give the patient pills, because then they will take antidepressants for, you know, 6 months, and it's like, yay, I'm good now. But they haven't made any changes in their lives. They mm-hmm. haven't reduced stress. They haven't gotten to know themselves, and so on. So it's really a band-aid. You just put it on, they go right in. You put it on, they go right back in. So so like when I first heard about this winter, one of my friends was in a really, really bad place. Like, you know, she was like full on suicidal. And she said that her doctor said that she shouldn't take medication. And I was just like, what? You know, you're about to like kill yourself. What do you mean you can't take medication? And then I talked to my friend who was a psychiatrist, and she said, yeah, this is what we're doing now. We're not putting band-aids on things. We're making people change their lives. And this friend of mine, she started meditating 4 times a day, and she is still doing it from like January to August, and she is better. But I think like if you had told me to start meditating 4 times a day, I would have just been, nope, not doing that, because I didn't understand what meditation does.
But you know what, by the way, when you were talking about the train station and what your doctor told you, well, it was a doctor that, hey, there is a thought, you just see it, but you don't have to get on the wagon or a train. That's how I've got people explain meditation to me, is that you are in that calm place, or place, it doesn't have to be calm, it's a place. Thoughts will come arriving, you just let them sort of go, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm very mindful that we can go into so many different directions from here, mm-hmm. because your history is so rich, and because you have these different experiences that you addressed in different ways, that we could, I kind of feel this is a second episode. On top of that, I also want to make sure that we just take a moment to acknowledge another thing. So the one thing that, by the way, that I find beautiful is the first time you talked about the understanding the biology and the biochemistry, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is a really good thing to point out for the people who find it, who are super comfortable talking about other biological things that are working for them. I mean, I had a conversation with a founder the other day who was talking about having been diagnosed with very low testosterone levels, right? And that's okay, because it doesn't affect your mental health on the surface. It was in the context of other things, right? But talking about an imbalance of hormones, things don't work in from a biology perspective, but affecting your mental and emotional well-being, I think that's a great thing. The other thing that I'm curious about, and this is now maybe bringing it all a little bit together, but also bringing it back to you, Aya, is you sort of threw it into the conversation occasion, but you didn't talk much about it, but you did talk about your diagnosis as being on the neurodiversity spectrum. Because when I met you in person, there was this moment where you were very vocal about having reached your limit for the day, and that you needed to withdraw and recharge. So there is something about, my question is very much around, okay, you had your experience with depression, you had your experience with being diagnosed with ADHD and autism. How do you communicate that with the outside world? And this also a little bit in the context of a leader who has a team or who works in a co-founding relationship, where you have reached that level of awareness about what your needs are, and you need to find a way of continuing to operate in the context of a team or a co-founding duo or a company.
It is very hard, especially because like with autism, people learn to mask and to please others. And so it's just like, you know, all these expectations and you want to be everything to everyone. And so I'm almost 40 and now it's the first time when I am learning to communicate my needs and it feels so stupid, but at this moment, because my autism diagnosis is so fresh, I can hear myself saying, well, you know, it's linked to my autism, and but it's like, you don't have to say this. I can just say, you know, I don't take any calls in the morning, or I can't do this, you know, I have to block out the week for this, or like even like the silly example, this last weekend, my friends and I went on this like mums without kids retreat for 2 days, and I had to ask them not to wear perfume, and I was just like, you know, there are these six women who are going to a city and getting a villa and going out, and I'm just like, if somebody wears perfume, you know, this will be the only thing I will be hearing in the room, or the only thing I hear.
Like, it's so such a strong sense for you. Got it. Mm-hmm.
But I was just like, oh my God, I can't even say that I don't wear perfume. And then it's like, okay, so these bigger things that are more important things, like, when will I get to this point when I'm, you know, that even at this point, it doesn't have to be autism diagnosis, but just most of us, we don't say these little things that bother us or that we need to function. And it's not just that we don't communicate them to others, but ourselves as well. I think like, you know, we wake up in the morning, it's like, everyone is functioning. I need to function. I must be functioning. So look at me functioning. Get up and you just, you know, and at one point I realized this, that every morning is struggle. So it's like, let's take a few steps back and let's see why every morning is a struggle. Like, what has led up to this, or what I could do better. And then, you know, it took me like 6 months every morning, think like, what is wrong in this picture? Like, what is making it so hard to start today, and so on. But I think this self-realization is such a big thing. Like, if you get to this point, everything else will start getting better. And today, even psychiatrists say that most people are neurodivergent, that these neurotypicals are
minority.
So I think at the moment, you know, people with like ADHD, people are discovering that they have it, especially like women at the age of like 35 or so on, when they have children, they have their own companies, and suddenly everything blows up and everyone tells them it's, you know, it's a trend disease. Like, you don't have it, you just want to be trendy. And these women, I'm talking about women now, but also men as well, but even before somebody else tells them this, in their mind, it's also like, oh, what's the matter with me? Like, why do I want this trendy thing? I'm just like a loser. I'm just an idiot. Like, I'm just not managing. And then I want to get a diagnosis. So this would explain everything. So it's like this internal, like, blah, 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 blah. And everyone else is also that, you know, all of us forget. and none of us really want to go to work, and this, and so everyone is making you feel like smaller, and so a lot of people, they don't even look into it. And I had this conversation yesterday throughout the whole day with my friend who is a sex coach. So I started sending her messages about like, hey, so at this point in my life, I have noticed a couple of things. And I'm like, wow, you know, so late in the game.
No, but God bless all the sex coaches. You know, we need more of them. Yes.
And so I started sending her these messages. And I said, you know, this thing might be attached to my ADHD and because of autism, like, how does this work? And then she started sending me these voice messages that, hey, so for a couple of years, I think I have ADHD. And even though she is a therapist, she also was doing this in her messages, like, yeah, of course, like nobody wants this or everyone is like this. And I'm like, you see, it's like we're taking all our suffering and telling ourselves, no, you don't have it. It's like keeping ourselves in denial and like, don't try to be special. You're just trying to be special. And this is your big ego that wants like, you know, attention. A battle to excuse you from stuff. But most of the time when people are starting to look at this avenue, like, do I have it or is there something I can do? It's because they are in really deep trouble. You know, people who are really happy with their ADHD, they don't start like finding out, like, I wonder if I have it. People who start noticing they're really struggling.
It's really beautiful to have you talk about the self-realization, because I think from Nectaris, I'm thinking from all the conversation, I think ultimately that's where we always arrive towards as the baseline. Can you share a little bit more? I'm thinking, how do you strengthen this? Like, some more tactics. Can we be a bit more practical? I'm not looking for the, you know, five tips to have a headline, you know, like something viral out there. But still, you mentioned maybe the moments of pause or not sort of having your mornings free. How, if for people who are listening, how else are you, maybe as an inspiration, practicing the self-realization to learn more about yourself and then turning it into practice someday better and then the other day not?
I think when you start noticing what you need, it's really hard to put these things into practice. Like, for example, when I finally realized that if I need to clean something in the morning in my house, clean up my house, I will have wasted all of my
for example, about following. I'm curious because that it resonates with me a little bit, so I'm curious where you're going with this.
So for example, ADHD, it's like a computer game where you have five lives or three lives. And you basically have like three things you can do in that day. And if you clean up the sink, you clean up the bathroom, you put away your kids' toys in the morning, you've already lost three lives that you have out of the five you have for that day. So it's like this amount of function that you have in your brain, it is very limited, and you will need to like see when you use it then for what. And for example, ADHD, if they have one meeting in the middle of the day, the rest of the morning is ruined, because from like seven onwards, they're like, okay, I have this thing at two. I have this thing at two. I have this thing at two. Mm-hmm. And so at first I thought, okay, I don't want to do things in the morning because my brain isn't on yet. And then I realized, oh yeah, but if I have it at two. And so I think it's very personal to see what works for you.
Okay.
And something that I'm working with now is whether I should have a lot of meetings one day and then have a day off, or I should have like one meeting every day. Like, which one is, less taxing for me. I'm still finding it out. Mm-hmm. But so I'm trying my schedule one way and another. So I think for the starting from September, I want to have all these very intense work meetings and workshops and exercise from Monday to Wednesday, so that Thursday to Sunday I can be creative but I don't know if it will work. Maybe
it's ultimately experimentation also. And being personalized to your own needs. I was just thinking that Tara's also like, if there are any guiding questions, like if we don't, which I think we don't have necessarily the answers, we can see some patterns and similarities, right? If there are some guiding questions that people could maybe walk away from this conversation with as well.
Maybe I can just jump in here, because in my very first conversation with Aya, which was a get to know each other conversation, I mentioned a couple of things about my life, and Aya just looked at me with this sort of slightly tilted head and a slight element of, you do realize that you show signs of autism. And I was like, well, and this goes back to something you said earlier, really, when somebody actually puts the finger on it, you kind of implicitly know something. Because especially if you have an element of self-reflection, you know that something could fall into the category. And then, of course, I took this to my therapist, and she looked at me and she did the same thing with a tilted head and said, everybody has elements. The question is, what do you do with it? Right? Mm-hmm. It's a little bit this neurodiversity as a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Traits, we all show traits. If it affects your life in a particular way and you feel you need to do something about it, that's where it gets interesting about what is it. I think I would actually, rather than going with like a leaving the audience with a question or two, rather create room for this to be more focused conversation on the subject, because there's a lot. I think if I was sort of replaying the conversation we had in my head, and we literally, if we were to say that in every episode we have a focus of one thing, maybe two, we talked about neurodiversity, we talked about depression, we talked about suicidal ideation, we touched upon trauma, we talked about so many different things. And in my head, and I don't know where this fits in this conversation, I'm struggling to bring it back together. The key thing is, ultimately, if I were to summarize what we talked about today and the way that you showed up, AI, is you've got a very poetic way and a very visual way of describing your experiences, which makes it really easy for people to connect. And of course, that's the creative person and the writer in you who has, I guess, practice in using the analogies of the little doors all shutting or the trains, right? And I think it's wonderful to see that you can go through all these experiences, and with the right type of support and with that curiosity of finding the right kind of help, you can just continue learning and being open to the new things that come, and being also very vulnerable and saying, I haven't figured this out. I don't know what September will bring when I'm experimenting with my different engagement model and my different calendar, which ultimately is what we want our audience to take away from this is, here's somebody who's been through a lot from a very young age, hardcore stuff, intense stuff, and still shows up with an openness and I'm not going to get this right, but there's no right, so I'm just keep trying to figure out what are the little things that I can do to get better. And for me, that's a beautiful way to sort of to end this conversation, but I don't want to have the last word.
When it comes to neurodiversity thing, also, like for me, getting these diagnoses was just like, I understand like everything now, like about myself, and it was so helpful to me. But then with most people I talk to, they're like, yeah, I might have it, I might not have it, maybe I'm just a loser. And I say, you don't need to like go and get the diagnosis. You know, you can just Google what is it about and how these people who have this help themselves. So to help yourself with these symptoms, you don't actually need a diagnosis. You can still Google, how do people with ADHD get organized? Mm-hmm. And you can use this help even without a doctor giving you tests and so on. So I think it works with like everything in life that that you can, like, for example, you know, movement. It doesn't matter what part of your body is sick or your mind is sick. And they tell you, you know, you need to move to create some endorphins. And it's like, no, I don't want to. But then scientifically, you know that it will make everything better. Like it is, movement is good for anything. So you should still move.
Yeah, let's do that there. Let's still move. But yeah, it's very powerful. Like I think, and I think I said a few times that we're powerful, but I think ultimately maybe it's empowering. I think that's what would be the one word that I would leave this conversation with, is that we can do quite a lot of things out there and to try. And as Nectarios beautifully said it, about the learning. And it's also really beautiful to see you, Aya, how alive you are. Like, I feel like that willingness to live and sort of the juiciness, I think that's what I'm getting from you today as well. So thank you for it. And thanks everyone for showing up with us on Naked.
Thank you, Aya.
Thanks. Okay.